Go for it.
Okay. You mentioned that Latin was not to be gotten rid of.
Right.
Okay. I know that the Mass went to the vernacular, but when did the actual records like baptism or marriage and stuff, it used to be written in Latin. Mm-hmm. When did it go to English?
Some of that happened even before the council. I mean, part of it, I think, was if Latin isn't being taught as much in seminaries, then the priests who are coming out of them aren't going to know it as well, and so when they're trying to do official documentation even, it might just be easier for them to just put it in the vernacular. Which is why one of the other things Vatican II called for was that Latin continue to be taught in the seminaries, and even more so than it was. And it makes you think, like, if Vatican II was saying that, they were saying that for a reason, and the reason was probably because at that time it had started to kind of grow lax. And so Vatican II was saying, no, don't let that happen, keep teaching Latin. But again, there's also something to be said about how universal the Church is without a universal language, you know? Like, we have a family in the parish who, part of the family is from Europe and from Spain, and they were having a kid baptized over there, and they needed a letter, because we're their parish, so we needed to write a letter to them saying, you have our permission to baptize outside of the parish. And I got tasked with this, and I thought, it would be really, really fun to put the letter in Latin. But then I thought, but God only knows whether or not the parish over there would understand it. So I just did it in Spanish. But I thought, you know, there would be a perfect example of, you know, saying, okay, I don't know what you speak, but here it is in Latin, you know. And that's how it used to be done, you know. Any kind of official communication, not just from the Vatican to everyone else, but even from priest to priest would have been in that language for the sake of understanding, you know. But especially in the liturgy, you know, because again, the liturgy is where we're all supposed to be coming together, so.
Yes. You said Gregorian chants had priority in place. What is priority in place?
Priority of place meaning not that it needs to dominate, because even at the time before the council, you still had hymnals and vernacular music, but what it was saying was a priority of place, meaning all other things being equal, it should be given the highest role. The majority of the music should be in Gregorian chant. For instance, in the Mass, and a lot of people don't know this, but I think a lot of the daily Mass crowd gets this a little bit more, because in the daily Mass, you know, when we don't sing anything, it says, you know, we recite the entrance antiphon together, and then after the priest's communion, we recite the communion antiphon together. Well, there were these several different antiphons throughout the Mass that, in a solemn Mass, would have been sung by the choir in Gregorian chant, and really, like, long and drawn out and repeated a few times. Whereas now we would just say it once very quick and then move on. And that was what kind of filled the Mass. Again, if those of you who were at my Solemn High Mass at September 14th, most of the time the choir was singing. And before Vatican II, that was kind of how it was done. The priest was reading all the same prayers, but when the priest finished one antiphon, he would then go right into the rest of the Mass. So, like, for instance, when it comes time for the Eucharistic prayer, and the choir starts the Sanctus, you know, Sanctus, Sanctus, Sanctus. The priest would just say, Sanctus, 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 Omnes Deus, Salve, Penis, Ecclesia, and finish the Sanctus, and then go right into the Eucharistic prayer. And then, Te Jesu Christus, Pater, and just go into the whole. And then, by the time the choir finished the Sanctus, the priest would be ready for the elevation. As soon as the elevation was over, the choir would go into the elevation. So the choir was doing a lot of those antiphons long and drawn out in Latin while the priest was continuing the Mass. And that was one of the things that Vatican II said, well, probably not a good idea. We should be doing things together. And so now, we all have to do it together. We all have to wait. Not necessarily a bad thing, but it's definitely different because now we will all recite it together. We'll all sing it together. And then once it's done, then the priest can go back to his part. And then once he's done, then the choir can go back to their part. So now it's a much more of a one person speaking at a time. Whereas before it wasn't done that way. But we had all these antiphons, and they would have been chanted throughout the Mass. And that was what Gregorian chant did. Gregorian chant took the very basic antiphons and strung them out based on ancient hymnody and ancient melody from the, actually, many claim coming all the way back from the Jewish prayer, that some people have made the claim that if you ever wanted to know what the ancient Jewish prayer in the temple sounded like, it sounded a lot like a Gregorian chant. That's where it came from, that type of drawing things out and the up and down and that kind of thing. So, did that answer your question? Or?
Do the documents explain any rationale and reasons for making those kind of statements, or does it just make the statements and this is the way it's going to be, this is what we should do? Do they back it up with any rationale and support it?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes no. Sometimes the document just say, like, this is how it's going to be. Most of the time, though, I mean, in their defense, I mean, most of the time, they have their reasons, and, you know, you may choose to disagree with them, but, you know, they are all the bishops gathered together, and you're not. You know what I mean? So, but most of the time, they gave explanation. And so, like, that last example, the explanation that was given was basically that there should be one thing going on at a time. That part of the full active and conscious participation of the people should be that there should only be one thing going on at a time. That when the choir is reciting the Sanctus, the priest should be singing along with them and not starting the Eucharistic prayer. So that's what we have now. So now, you know, before I can begin the Eucharistic prayer, I have to wait for the choir to finish singing the Sanctus and then everyone to kneel. And then I can begin, you know. And for right or wrong, you know, I'm not in a position to judge. But it can certainly make the Mass longer. Now, the older Mass was longer, but I think it takes about the same amount of time to do now, because now you're stretching everything out by making everyone wait for each other. Back then, when it was longer, there were people talking over each other, and it's just a different experience for me. And even as a priest, when I first started celebrating the old Mass, it was very weird for me sometimes because the choir was still singing, and I was like, okay, well, I finished, so I'm going to start, you know. So sometimes, yeah, a lot of the document, they do give those kinds of reasons. And again, you can, and people do disagree with those reasons. One thing that, just to say one last thing in answer to your question, one thing that I was that I didn't particularly like was not in the document itself, but in some of those documents that came out afterwards from that little council that was kind of given the authority to implement. If you read some of those documents, there aren't many reasons given. It's this will happen, this will happen, this will not happen anymore, this will happen, this will happen, this will happen. And it's just, you know, now part of it was that was their job. This document reads a little bit more like poetry than regulation, and that was intentional. I mean, it was meant to be a very beautiful, you know, exposition on the liturgy and what the liturgy is, and it wasn't meant to kind of be laying down norms, although it does some of that, those very broad general norms. It was those later documents. And you can bash those later documents as much as you want because, yeah, they had the authority of the Pope behind them, but it wasn't with the wisdom of all of the bishops assembled together. It was a few people who were put together to kind of decide how to implement this document in a very nitty-gritty way. And some of those documents, you wonder, like, well, why? Why should I do that? But it just says, do it. And you say, okay, well, I'm obedient, so I'm going to do it. But, no, so.
So it's really the documents in three stages. You have the main document, and you have what you call the motu whatever.
The motu proprio, yeah.
Which set up a small group that comes out with explanation.
Right.
The nitty-gritty piece. So you can have multiple of those documents.
Right. So, but I guess the point I was making is when we talk about the 16 documents of Vatican II, that motu proprio and those other documents that came from that little group, that they're not part of those 16. This is the only one of those 16. So there was one document from Vatican II that dealt with the liturgy, and this was it. All the other 15 documents of Vatican II dealt with other topics. And so, not to sound like I'm splitting hairs, but I would give a much greater weight to the actual documents that came out of the council, that came out of the assembled bishops from all over the world. I would give much greater authority to that than out of a little council that was set up later on to kind of implement it. Now, they had the authority to do that. The Pope established them to do that, and that was their job. But they're not carrying the weight of the worldwide episcopate. So, I mean, it... yeah.
So did the other 15 documents then have follow-up?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of them did. A lot of those other documents had kind of follow-up on how to. Because, I mean, when you think about it, the council was tackling a lot of different issues, and especially something like reforming the liturgy. I mean, imagine if you were a parish priest and you got a copy of Sacrosanctum Concilium. It gives you a whole bunch of general norms, but it doesn't tell you, like, okay, what do I do now? Like, some of the things that Vatican II said was, like, okay, the lectionary should be revised so that more of the Bible is covered. Okay, who's going to actually do that? And so, obviously, there is a perfect example of you need another group to come along later and say, okay, Vatican II asked us to put more of the Bible in the lectionary, so how do we put more of the Bible in the lectionary? Okay, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to have a three-year cycle and yada, yada, yada. That makes sense, you know, because a lot of times it called for something to be done. Okay, well, you need someone then to come along and do it. And then just those kind of general norms. So, like, for instance, a lot of those general norms that were issued, and maybe this answers your question a little better, Bob, but a lot of those general norms that were issued fell under this notion of full, active, and conscious participation. You know, because we want the faithful to have full, conscious, and active participation, the priest should face them and so they can see the altar better. Because we want full, active, and conscious participation, there should only be one person talking at a time. Because we want full, active, and conscious participation, boom, 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 boom. So I think that was perhaps why. But yeah, all the documents had kind of follow-up documents. But I guess the point I'm making is that those follow-up documents don't have the weight of an ecumenical council. If you want to know what Vatican II said, you have to look at the documents. If you want to know what some group that was put together after Vatican II to implement Vatican II said, well, sure, look at those documents, and they have the authority of the Church, but hardly that level of authority. That's something that we're kind of missing, that we don't think about enough, is that even in the Church's documents, there are levels. Which things are more, you know, that some things are more important than others, you know?
These groups that were put together, was this on a local basis, or this was one group was deciding how these were going to be implemented for the whole world?
Yeah.
Or was it?
No, it was the latter, yeah. So, like, after this document came out, Pope Paul VI put together the Concilium, whose job was, and it was comprised of people from not all over, but you know, it wasn't just a bunch of Italians that got together. I mean, but yeah, it was a small group of people, and their job was to implement Sacrosanto Concilium for the whole world. Yeah. Now, the document says, like, for local exceptions, you know, you can have local exceptions for this reason, for that reason, but it gives a whole procedure of approval. Like, it said, and like I was saying before, like, the priest can't decide, well, I don't want to do that. And it says that even, like, an individual bishop can't. Like, the bishop's conference of a particular country can get together and say, you know, in the United States, we really think it would be great if we did X. And then they can vote on that. They can pass that decision to the Vatican, and the Vatican can say, okay, we agree with you, do it. Or they can say, no, we don't like that idea, don't do it. But those would have all been exceptions. And that process is still in place today. You know, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops could unanimously decide they want to do something, and they still have to get the Vatican's approval before they can do it and make it particular law as opposed to, like, universal law.
So I know you said the Vatican Council was all of the bishops. Are we talking hundreds of people or thousands of people? Just for a point of reference.
Yeah, it was about... It was about 2,500 bishops, 2,000 to 2,500 bishops. But not just the bishops. The bishops were the ones who had a vote. So if you were a bishop, you had a vote. But the council also included a lot of experts. So you'd have people who were theological experts. So, like, for instance, our current pope, John Paul II, God rest him, Benedict, God did rest him, he's a blessed now, Benedict, then Father Joseph Ratzinger, he was not a bishop, so he didn't have a vote, but he was a theological expert at Vatican II. He was, if you do a Google search on Joseph Ratzinger, like younger Joseph Ratzinger, you see like this picture of him, like, you know, in clerics and hair slicked back and very cool looking guy, you know. So he was one of the people there, but he wouldn't have had a vote. But they had a lot of experts brought in. They had, you know, they had nuns, they had priests, they had they even invited some Protestants.
Is this the small group? No.
This was the council.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those would be people that had a specialty in something.
Yeah. Whose job was to kind of advise, and but they didn't have a vote. The idea was, and we'll cover this more when I do the document on the church, but the idea was when a man is ordained a bishop, it's not just a juridical thing, like, okay, now he's a bishop. The theology behind that is that he has received a special outpouring of the Holy Spirit. He has become a successor to the apostles. He now has the ability and the responsibility to govern the church, and in a universal way. And so it was understood, and it still is, that only when the bishops gathered together, that they were the ones who were uniquely qualified on a spiritual level, not just an academic intellectual level, but on a spiritual level to really kind of discern what God wanted and what he didn't, and to vote on it and to put it into effect. So
with all these people from all over the world, was Latin what was spoken there?
Yep. In fact, you know, we don't think of Latin as being like spoken off the cuff now, but it was. When Pope John the 23rd, now blessed John the 23rd, when he opened the Second Vatican Council 50 years ago this month, he gave an off-the-cuff opening statement for about 20 minutes in Latin. John the 23rd, they all processed in, all the bishops, and he was carried in on his chair, and he got up and he just talked for 20 minutes, just kind of welcoming everyone. Archbishop Wuerl, he's in Rome right now for this big synod of bishops, which is... smaller than an ecumenical council. It's not all the bishops in the world. It's a select group of bishops from all over the world to discuss issues, but it's a lesser importance kind of thing. So again, it's not an ecumenical council. This is a smaller gathering of bishops that's going on right now to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Vatican II. The Pope made Cardinal Wuerl, our Archbishop, the Relator General of the Synod, so like the head guy in charge of this whole Synod right now, and he had to give his whole opening statement in Latin. And so Cardinal Wuerl spoke for like 30 minutes in Latin. Now, he had it written out, and I'm sure he was reading it, but yeah, I mean, all of the deliberations would have been done in Latin. And that's kind of interesting to think, like, can you imagine, like, bishops from all over the world, like, arguing with each other in Latin? You know, like, that's kind of interesting for me to, yeah. But again, that would have been the language, because even at the time of Vatican II, the church had spread all over the world. I mean, and if you were a bishop, you had a vote. So you could be bishop of Madagascar, and you were at Vatican II, and you would be arguing with the bishop from the United States, and it would be in Latin, because what other language did the two of you know, you know? Brett, I'll come back.
Why were the Protestants invited?
Some of them were invited, yeah, because we want to be nice and want to get their insights. And we did, and we invited the Orthodox too. Some of the Orthodox. But part of it was, and again, I mean, they're not fully initiated in the church, because they don't have those other two sacraments that I said before you need to be fully initiated. But they are true members of the church by virtue of their valid baptism. So if they were validly baptized, then they are members of the church. They're not in full communion. They don't have full initiation. But I think, and that did us a lot of good as a church. I mean, to be able to say, you know, we've invited not only our bishops and our people, but, you know, we've asked for the Protestants to come and give us their input, and the Orthodox to come and give us their input. And
are the Episcopalians still using the Lord be with you and also with you?
Oh, yeah, everyone else uses that, yeah, which they got from us. But yeah. Well, because they don't have a Latin normative edition that says et cum spiritu tuo, which means and with your spirit. They don't have that. They just have the English. And with thy spirit, I think, is what they would say. But, Mary...
I was alive when Vatican II.
What? No, you weren't.
I was like 2 years old. Anyway, I don't understand how is it that the church got to the point where the Mass was being said in Latin and yet people didn't understand the Latin. Why did it get to the point where it was necessary? I mean, why weren't children taught Latin to begin with?
Yeah.
Second grade.
Yeah. A lot of people were learning it, but I think part of it was it was beginning to fall out of use in the secular realm, and I think the church thought, well, kind of have to deal with what you've got, and if you have more and more people who aren't learning Latin...
Didn't we always have Latin on the left and English on the right?
Yes, but the question becomes... I mean, from a pastoral point of view, if you're one of the bishops at the council and you're saying, well, wait a minute, I don't like it, but less and less people are learning Latin. I don't like it, I didn't want it, but it's happening. Less and less people, fewer and fewer people are learning Latin. So what do I do? Do I keep it in Latin and just say, well, sucks to be you? Or do we say, okay, well, maybe we can allow some vernacular? And they kind of took a middle ground. They said, well, Latin will remain the official language. It will have priority of place in the liturgy. But we will allow certain things to be done in the vernacular. Specifically those things that the people should be hearing. So like, for instance, the first thing to be allowed to be done in the vernacular were the readings. Because they thought, well, they should hear those, because those change all the time. You know, the Eucharistic prayer, that never changes, and so that can stay in Latin, you know. And they don't need to really hear that. It was quiet anyways. The priest whispered the Eucharistic prayer. But I think it was a matter of the bishops just kind of saying, this is the presenting problem, and how do we want to handle it? But again, I think... actually, that would be interesting. Show of hands, how many of you as... kids Or, let's say this. How many of you at any time in your life have gotten a chance to study Latin? Yeah. So, okay.
I think it was an economic problem. It used to be when you were a Catholic kid, you always went to a Catholic school, and that's where it was taught. So you started going to non-Catholic schools because of economic problems.
Sure.
And that's where the degrading of Latin teaching happened. So
yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. It could have had to do with, you know.
It was an academic problem because my mother was a child. Catholic school was free.
Right.
Anybody could go to the Catholic school. Mm-hmm. And they started charging tuition.
Right.
Once they started charging tuition, public school was it. Public school didn't teach Latin.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. I mean, I went to public school my whole life in Montgomery County, Maryland, and we could take Latin in high school.
They still offer it.
Yeah, no, that's not everywhere, but I think you're, I mean, that was part of it, but, well, now the issue there, too, was, well, why did Catholic schools need to start charging tuition? A lot of it was because once you didn't have any more nuns to teach, and you had to hire lay people who were married and had kids and had to support themselves, you know, a nun, you don't need to pay because you're paying the convent, you're paying their house, you're paying their food, and they don't need money because they're under a vow of poverty. But that could be part of it is, you know, they weren't going to Catholic schools and they weren't learning it at Catholic schools. But, yeah. But that's why I think it's important that Latin continue to be taught. And even apart from the whole issue of the church, I mean, the whole church aside, and the whole, you know, faith and all that aside for a second, just its value in learning other languages, just its value in learning English better.
Science,
anything. Yeah. Yeah, so.
At what point did some of the things come out like you don't stand that they were alive or you stand that they were
in? We didn't hear what he said.
What did he say?
That was a local aberration. And I mean very local, like this parish. This parish is the only parish that I've ever seen that stands at the wrong place. Everyone stands here when the priest washes his hands. And they're actually not supposed to. Now, lest I get yelled at from the pastor, I am not telling you to no longer stand at the lavabo. I am not giving you that directive, nor do I have the authority to give you that directive. I'm simply observing that we do it at the wrong time, that we're never supposed to do it. That's what Bob's getting at.
But something came out when Father Matt first was there.
I'm sure it did.
Yes, Father Matt, he said. He said, do it, so you do it.
Well, the thing that came out was, and this was part of the full active and conscious participation, the thing that came out was that the assembly should stand when they are going to speak. And therefore, right before you speak, so the issue was, okay, well, when do you stand to speak? Do you stand as you're speaking? Do you speak and then stand? Or do you stand and then speak? And the decision that came out was that you should stand and then speak. And so it was said, okay, well, stand right before the response. But so what happens everywhere else in the world, except for Sacred Heart of Bleda, what happens everywhere else in the world is the priest washes his hands, and then he says, pray, brothers and sisters, that my sacrifice and yours may be acceptable to God, the Almighty Father. Then everyone stands. Once they're standing, may the Lord accept the sacrifice at your hand. You know, so it's you're standing in order to speak. You're not standing because the priest is washing his hands. Why are you standing for the priest to wash his hands? It doesn't make sense. You're standing to respond. It's like I'm talking to you, and now you stand and you respond. So that's how it's supposed to be done. But again, I am not telling you. I don't have the authority. I'm just saying. But you know what? If that's like the only liturgical abuse that happens at this parish, and I think it is, we are golden. Because so many other places, I mean...
You got one more.
Well,
holding those
hands. Oh, well, yeah. There's that too, yeah. I'm not supposed to hold hands during the Our Father, yeah.
A general question.
Yes.
What's the criteria for genuflecting? I noticed when you had your Latin Mass...
Oh, for genuflecting,
was it also
Right. Well, again, don't think of it as the Latin Mass. Think of it as the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite. So we are all Roman Rite. And there is the ordinary form of the Roman Rite, which basically means the liturgy after Vatican II. And then there is the extraordinary form of the Roman Rite, which means the liturgy before Vatican II. Either can be done in Latin. I can do the ordinary form. I can do the current Mass in Latin. So don't think of it as the Latin Mass. It's the extraordinary form. In the extraordinary form, in the liturgy before Vatican II, there was a lot of repetition. The priest made the sign of the cross 52 times in the Mass. The priest did a lot of genuflections whenever he crossed the tabernacle. Down, down, down. Now, I think that's kind of cool. That's just me. I think it's kind of cool. One of the things Vatican II called for, and here's that's a perfect example. I'm glad you brought it up. One of the things Vatican II called for was a simplification, a noble simplicity, and that we shouldn't be repeating things unnecessarily. And so the thought was, well, why make 52 signs of the cross when just one will suffice? So that's what we have now. Boom, boom. There's the one sign of the cross made over the bread and wine before it's consecrated. But in the old Mass, the priest made several signs of the cross over the bread and wine, and then over the bread by itself, and then over the wine by itself, and then over both of them, and then would actually consecrate. And then after the consecration, more signs of the cross, and then take the host and make the sign of the cross, and then take the paten and make the sign of the cross with the paten. And there was a lot of that. Yeah. And the thought was, we don't need that. Now again, this is just me, John Rudiman. I think it's kind of fun and kind of cool and cultic, and I enjoy it.
At the age of, people changing minds.
Oh, me. Oh, I don't know. Maybe. I'm going to be martyred in a few years, whatever. So.
Did you hear what he said?
What?
When you get arthritis in the knees.
When you get arthritis in the knees. Well, you know, I have to wonder which came first. Is it because they weren't genuflecting that they got lazy and got arthritis? Or did they get lazy and get arthritis because they stopped genuflecting?
No, that was the weather.
No, I'm just kidding. No, it is, but he... Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Anything else? Okay, good. So, I haven't decided which document we'll do next time, but it'll be one of the other 15 documents.